I love you.
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 What is this thing called love? What makes it happen? Does science have an answer? I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I think cure is our new favorite word.
If you poke them and they don't move, then we figure they're pretty much anesthetized.
Throw them in a blender, and then what you have in the blender is a big soup full of all sorts of plant material, but also this virus we're interested in.
The Descoby is a disgusting gelatinous blob that looks like a weird alien that you would not want anywhere near your food.
Well, I hope you remember that we had at least a brief discussion in the recovery area immediately after this.
That's kind of what we're trying to fix by putting it right on your face.
Failure is actually just part of the process.
And I remember
generally,
And
then that was it.
Today's show is about love and lust, but it's not going to get all hot and heavy in here because we're breaking love and lust down to their scientific elements. Not very sexy, but so interesting. We'll put aphrodisiacs to the test, examine if music can make you fall in love, and we'll preach the gospel of public health on Grindr. Let's start with love. It's a shared universal experience. Around the world, people feel love. We talk about it, we sing about it, we write about it and watch movies about it, but the thing is, we don't really understand love, what makes it happen, or why we feel it. Anthropologist Helen Fisher is one of the scientists looking to unlock the secrets of love. She's been using MRI brain scans to show that a primitive part of the brain is activated when people are newly in love.
It's part of what we call the reptilian core of the brain, associated with wanting, with motivation, with focus, and with craving. In fact, the same brain region where we found activity becomes active also when you feel the rush of cocaine.
This study prompted headlines like, "Falling in love is like smoking crack cocaine." Do I have your attention? Here's Carolyn Beeler with more.
Helen Fisher has become the public face of the science of love. She writes books on the topic and is the chief scientific officer for the dating website Match.com. But it's her research partner who's responsible for the brain science behind these discoveries.
I'm Lucy Brown, clinical professor in neurology at Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx.
Brown wears trendy tortoiseshell glasses, and her thick silver hair is pulled back into a bun. She speaks about her work with a kind of gentle enthusiasm. She had spent much of her career studying the brain's reward systems, and in 1996, Helen Fisher asked her to use the relatively new technology of functional MRI imaging to peer inside the brains of those newly in love.
To reveal, to find the brain systems of romantic love, even just to find out if there was such a thing.
In their first experiment, Brown's team put 17 college students into scanners and showed that this primitive part of the brain, the ventral tegmental area, lit up in scans while the subjects looked at pictures of their partners. That lighting up represented increased blood flow and activity in that primitive region. The results changed the way Brown thinks about love.
It's a drive. It's like hunger or thirst. It's really part of our survival system, which was, in a way, kind of a surprise because we tend to think, oh, they're just in love. You know, they'll get over it. Oh, no, no. This is very important to all of us.
For most people, the fluttery feelings of early love morph into strong attachment a few years into a relationship. Brown says anecdotal observations show that as that happens, this primitive part of the brain stops being activated. That is, for the majority of people.
But there are a few people who say, oh, no, it's just like the first 6 months. Now, psychologists had known this for a while from questionnaire studies they'd done. And they wondered, were these people really in love in the same way? Or did they have some need to say they were? Or were they lying on the questionnaires? You know, what's going on?
To find out, Brown's team recruited another 17 people. This time, those who had been married for decades but said they were still madly in love. Their claims turned out to be measurably true. Their brain scans showed activation in the primitive VTA, similar to those newly in love.
I remember when I saw that first result, I said, wow, she says she's in love with him still, just as she was in the beginning, and she is. I must say that I myself didn't think it would be possible to be married that long and still have that same kind of obsession feeling.
Now, the whole time Brown was researching this obsessive love, she was falling for someone herself. She was a widow, he a widower, and it was love at first kiss.
Realizing what was going on in my brain kind of enriched the experience. I was thinking, ay, 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 I know how this is going to take over my life.
A few weeks after they got married in 2010, Brown decided to turn the brain scanning tables. She did an fMRI on herself as a gift to her husband. Brown walked into a scanning bay at Einstein College of Medicine and went through the same process as her subjects. She lay down in the cold MRI tube.
So I was rolled into the MRI. In this case, we had goggles.
And watched as her husband Herb's face appeared in those goggles.
Wow, that's close. And oh, he looks so great.
She thought romantic thoughts as instructed and then was assigned a distraction task.
And then suddenly I had to do the countback task.
Brown looked at a picture of a friend for 20 seconds as a control and repeated the process over and over. Back at her computer recently, Brown shows me her brain scans. In the center, there's the reptilian brain that's responsible for hunger, thirst, and this primitive need for love.
See this tiny little red area? It's so small, but so powerful. This is in the ventral tegmental area, in me.
Brown said she fully expected to see that area light up in red in her scan, showing increased activity. And it did. But another result surprised her. In the scan, there's also a big patch of blue in the front part of the brain, showing decreased activity. It's in the brain region responsible for negatively judging other people. Research from her team had shown that this decreased activity early on in a relationship was a good predictor that the relationship would last.
I thought, oh boy, this is great. I'm glad to see this. I had felt that it was going to last, but somehow it's funny. It is a good feeling when you see that physiological effect that you know is a good predictor. Yeah, it does kind of help to solidify the feeling of this is going to last.
Brown repeated the scan 2 years into her marriage, curious about what would change over time.
The ventral tegmental area definitely is gone. That activation is gone.
As Brown expected, this intense early stage love didn't last long for her.
And I'm sad to say that the deactivation, the suspension of negative judgment, isn't quite as as prominent as before, but it's still there.
Other than self-discovery, there are some practical applications that this line of research has prompted. Anna Zilverstand is a researcher at Mount Sinai in New York who's made findings similar to Brown's in the resting brains of those newly in love.
We were interested in finding out how the brain works when we are feeling positive emotions in order to learn how we can maybe stimulate these positive emotions in people who have difficulty feeling them, like, for example, people who are depressed.
This approach is called neurofeedback, and Zilverstand says it's had some preliminary success.
We are able to show people their brain activation while they're in the scanner, and it has been shown that people can learn how to modulate these brain regions that are active during a positive state, and then hopefully this is going to lead to them also feeling better.
Lucy Brown has a more philosophical motivation. She thinks it's important we understand the power of love so neither it nor heartbreak is brushed away as trivial. She plans on scanning herself about once a year to learn how her love changes over time. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you.
Our show today is about love and lust, and we can't talk about either without devoting some time to kissing, like in this iconic scene from the movie Casablanca.
You knew how much I loved you, how much I still love you.
Oh, and then they kiss, and it just feels so right. Pulse contributor Audrey Quinn explores kissing and why we love to watch it.
I was running laps around this park in my neighborhood. It's about the size of two big city blocks up on a slope. One thing I like about this park is that it's just so well used. There's an older man running reps on the stairs, a 30-something couple doing lunges between the picnic tables, two moms doing aerobics to a boombox, their kids playing in the grass. And on this night, there's a middle-aged couple using a park bench. It sits up on the high edge of the park, facing the lawn. They're seated side by side, their bodies rotated towards each other, arms around each other's backs. And as the sun's going down, this man and woman are kissing so, so deeply. My running loop takes me right in front of them. So about every 3 minutes, I come up the hill and around the bend, and there they are, still kissing. Again and again and again. And each time, I'm staring and feeling a bit like a creep. It's like kisses bring out this struggle between don't look and can't look away. Kind of like public nudity, this exposure of such shameless intimacy. Which makes me wonder why we do this weird gesture, mash our faces together to show love. I mean, there's a bunch of theories for why we first started kissing. It could have evolved from the suckling motion we make as nursing babies, or how moms pass chewed food to their newborn mouth to mouth when baby food's not around. Or kissing could have come from a smelling gesture, a close sniff to take in a person fully and judge if they're baby-making material. A bunch of cultures do nose kissing, totally lips-free. I later brought up that couple's kiss to Cheryl Kirschenbaum. She wrote the book The Science of Kissing. She says what we do know is that man and woman's neural pathways for kissing were laid down when they were newborns, getting kissed by their parents. She says there's no other activity where all our senses are so actively engaged as when we kiss lips to lips. Kissing another person's lips releases the same hormone a baby gets when they nurse from their mom. You are loved. You are cared for. Good kisses bring out a pretty much euphoric burst of the neurotransmitter dopamine. That couple on the park bench are evidence, as if you needed any, that kissing just feels good. And why my urge to stare? There's these things called mirror neurons. They help us feel the feelings of another person. So watching other people kiss can be like vicariously experiencing a kiss ourselves. Some of the same cells end up firing in our brains. There's something that makes me feel a little cynical about my initial reaction to that couple. I first was a bit nervous they weren't just kissing. I was afraid if I looked too close, I might see a little more than I bargained for on a summer evening jog. But no, all that passion they were showing, that high that made them oblivious to a peeping jogger, that was all from kissing. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.
Coming up, is this pill a game changer for safe sex?
To present it to patients, you know, you just see them go, what? Really? Like, I can do this? This will work for me?
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca, offering resources to help patients afford and access their medicines. The AZ and Me patient assistance programs provided more than 382,000 patients in the U.S. with more than $670 million in savings in 2014. AstraZeneca Direct offers a range of patient support services, including delivery of brand-name prescription medications directly to a person's home. More at AstraZeneca-US.com.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about love and lust. If you're in the mood for either, a like-minded person is probably just a click or a swipe away on a dating or hookup app. And here comes the mood killer. These easy connections have recently been blamed for a rise in sexually transmitted diseases. For example, recent data shows syphilis cases among men increased by 10%. Between 2012 and 2013. How do public health people keep up with all of this when the technology is changing all the time? Joining us now is Dan Wolfiler. He's a researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. Dan has been working on HIV and STD prevention since the late 80s. His research focuses on gay men, but what he is learning about technology applies across the board. Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
What's your take? Are hookup apps to blame for rises in STD rates?
Apps certainly have a lot to do with STDs, but they can be both a force in favor of transmission and they can also be a force in favor of prevention. Sites can make it a lot more efficient to find a partner. You don't have to wait till a weekend. You don't have to, you know, go to a party or a bar to find a partner. And instead of being 4 or 5 degrees of separation away from someone with an STD, you can be only 2 or 3 degrees away. So we know that gay men and certainly some heterosexuals, but not as many, who have syphilis, when we interview them, they report meeting partners online. But we also know that it's not nearly as strong a predictor of being infected with an STD as, say, using methamphetamines.
You mentioned the sites could be a force for prevention. How so?
In injury control, they put banks in the curves of freeways to keep people safe so that they don't hurt themselves or others. They don't spin off the freeway as they're driving fast. And so the challenge is, how do we build a safer online freeway where people are going to meet new partners? And that takes a lot of different strategies. One thing that obviously the sites can do is get information out there incredibly efficiently and incredibly quickly and much more efficiently, say, and at a much lower cost than putting up billboards or bus shelters or broadcasting a message. So we've been working with the owners of a lot of the sites and apps to get information out to their customers. And as an example, for the last World AIDS Day on December 1st, we worked with them and they were able to drive 30,000 people to the CDC's directory of where to get tested by putting banner ads up. The sites have really demonstrated their willingness and they really want to work with us. So being able to search, for example, for a partner to see if they're interested in also having safe sex and using condoms is really useful from a public health point of view. And it was something that most of the owners said, we're willing to do that.
Would it be possible to really personalize little messages? Let's say I have opted, you know, to meet somebody, and let's say I've previously opted that, oh, I don't like to use condoms. And then maybe I'll get a little pop-up message that says, hey, are you sure you want to do this? Or do you know that not using a condom means, you know, your chances of getting X is this much higher? Could you really make this a very personal thing?
You know, we found out something interesting when it came to asking people if they want reminders to get tested. And the original strategy we had was, wouldn't it be great if one of the sites or one of the apps would send out a message every 3 months or every 6 months to get tested? And when we asked guys about it, they weren't very excited about it. And when we said, what if you could control the interval so they could say, we want to get that message every 3 months, we want to get it every 6 months, or someone who's even more sexually active and has a lot of partners might want to get that message even more frequently. And that idea had a lot of support. And for us, the message was, if the technology comes across as sending out spam, people aren't going to want it. But if they feel that they have control and they're essentially leveraging that technology to help themselves, they'll be much more likely to use it. The trick is to give people the power over the technology to get what they want. I think one of the most important areas of agreement between the sites and the users and public health is that we all know that guys are on there to meet partners. They're not on there typically to get education. And so what we need to do is figure out how can we help them make really informed choices about their partners in addition to getting messages.
Dan, what's the next big thing public health people are thinking about? Where does your message need to go next? Any ideas?
One, it's really important that we go where the people are. And if people are moving to a new technology, we need to go. We need to respect their privacy. We need to respect the fact that they're probably not there to get information from us, but that they want to meet new partners. And we need to work with them to figure out how to do that safely.
Dan, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Dan Wolfiler is a researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, and he has been working on HIV and STD prevention since the 1980s.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is about love and lust. And right now, we're focusing on the potential fallout from amorous adventures. HIV remains a major concern, but there is a new approach called pre-exposure prophylaxis that could protect people from contracting the virus. It's effective, but controversial. Alana Gordon met a man who is on the front lines of this revolutionary development in more ways than one.
John Vaz is 34. He's fit and smart. A real catch. And a little over a year ago, he found himself in a somewhat unusual situation. For him, he was single. It didn't last long.
We actually met on Grindr.
It's a popular hookup app.
It was fairly innocuous.
Uh-huh.
I was sitting at home watching a French movie with a friend.
Vaz lives in D.C.
And he was somewhere else in D.C. watching a movie on a Shabbat dinner night with his friends.
They talked movies for a bit.
We exchanged phone numbers.
And then they met for coffee the next day.
And so you just started, like, immediately, like... Sparks or like?
I think at the time, really enjoyed spending time with each other, and a coffee date became a sort of hangout date, and then let's get dinner, and then let's go back to yours, and you know.
A few months later, they moved in together. It was fantastic. It was comfortable. Something was missing.
Suffice to say, life is too short for bad sex.
Vaz and his partner decided to open up their relationship. They were still committed to each other, but agreed it was okay to have other sexual partners. Vaz was totally on board, but he did worry about one thing, HIV. He uses condoms, but with their new relationship status, what if? What if?
The barrier methods of protection might fail on my own volition or unintentionally.
This brought Vaz face to face with a new option, a new preventive tool that hadn't really been around before. It's called PrEP.
PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis.
PrEP is a combination HIV drug, brand name Truvada. Studies have shown that if it's taken consistently once a day, it can reduce the risk of HIV up to 90% compared with those who don't take it. Vaz was in a quandary. Should he take PrEP? I should note there is some irony here, because Vaz is an infectious disease doctor.
You know, we are also human even if we are... physicians.
He's the HIV director at one of the biggest health centers in Baltimore, and he has several dozen patients on PrEP. Dr. Vaz says HIV is a powerful virus, but it needs to take control of cells to proliferate.
They cannot do anything by themselves. They need to get into a cell and hijack a cell's machinery to survive.
But the drug Truvada, if it's already in a person's body at the right levels, basically stops the HIV virus from taking over that cell. And so the virus dies. Some advocates liken PrEP to birth control for HIV. They see it as a major, I mean major, prevention tool.
Some of the modeling that the WHO did showed that in the next 10 years, if PrEP was rolled out to men who have sex with men, it could avert 1 million infections. That's a huge number.
Reported side effects can include some nausea at first. Vaz says the main thing is monitoring a person's kidneys, because that's how the drug's secreted. The FDA approved PrEP in 2012, and last year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended those at highest risk for HIV take it. That includes people with HIV-positive partners. For Vaz, the guidelines opened up access to PrEP to his patients, because it meant insurance would start covering it.
For me personally, I went, yes.
The drug costs about $1,200 a month. Now, it has stirred some controversy. What if people miss dosages? How protected are they? What if it leads to riskier behavior and higher STD rates? That hasn't shown to be the case. For many, PrEP's still a really new concept. But for Vaz, in his own practice, the real success of PrEP is not about writing a prescription.
But it also allows for us then to have this forum of someone's life, which, you know, health is about so much more than just giving someone pills.
He's seen it open up conversations about stigma, about HIV, whatever one's status, about sexuality, about fear, about intimacy.
It really just helps people to start thinking about their sexual health and make good decisions in their quieter moments of their lives that hopefully will pervade those heat of the moment, lustful, passionate moments.
Vaz, if you'll remember, was 50-50 about taking PrEP himself. He consulted his own primary care provider. In the end, he decided it wasn't right for him, at least not then.
Trust me, if I felt like I needed it, I would have said, no, I'm going on it.
Part of his reasoning was his open relationship. It didn't pan out.
I think there's no prescribed way to do things. And we really did enjoy the year that we had together and just, you know, sort of shaking together. And, you know, we are the best of friends. And I love him dearly, and I always will.
But Vaz realized they weren't in love. Vaz is in a new relationship now. And while he's not taking PrEP, his former partner and now really good friend is. That gives Vaz a lot of peace of mind, because he thinks weighing those decisions is as much about loving oneself as it is someone else. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're talking about love and lust today. And as it turns out, Philadelphia will soon be home to the country's first sex toy vending machine. It's called Pink Box, and it will sell condoms plus a range of other things for the experimental couple or do-it-yourselfer. We asked Todd Bookman to find out more.
Pink boxes will be located in places where adults and alcohol tend to mix, along with other age-appropriate venues. So there's little likelihood you'll pass by one while walking around with your mom. The machine looks like the type of thing you'd get a bag of Doritos out of, and its prices are low thanks to no overhead. I sat down with one of the company's co-founders, sex columnist and sexuality educator Timmery Schmidt. We started with the obvious.
So why do we need a sex toy vending machine?
Well, we don't need anything, but it's a fascinating and really important thing to have available because sexuality is a really intrinsic part of being a person, and pleasure is an inherently valuable thing. And anything that can bring us more opportunities for pleasure, more opportunities for intimacy with other humans, which is another need, those things are great.
More opportunities to buy pleasure-producing objects, in theory, means more pleasure. Except there's not really any obstacles to purchasing adult toys anymore. Still, Schmidt says with the internet, you have to wait a few days for delivery, certainly a mood killer. She also defends Pink Box against criticisms, like the things we do behind closed doors should stay behind closed doors.
Everybody has a different idea of what is shameful and embarrassing, and we have drawn very arbitrary delineations about which bodily functions are acceptable to do in public and acceptable to even talk about in public. And those things are just socially constructed. So if we just talked about these things more often, we would be more comfortable. And that's part of why this is something I really believe in, because any opportunity that we have to talk about these things, then we can be like, I'm into that, and I like this, or I don't like that, and that's fine too.
Schmidt says America's puritanical roots mask our ability to focus on what feels good and what our bodies are capable of. Perhaps we do think too much in terms of shouldn't and should.
I want to take away the word should from sexuality as much as possible, so I don't think anybody should do anything, but I want people to feel empowered to make whatever decisions are consistent with their values, that are you know, interesting to them, whether alone or with someone else, that that they feel enthusiastic about it or curious about it, that simply we don't say no for no good reason.
Aya Schmidt, though, aren't we already oversaturated with sex from media and marketing?
We are saturated with a very particular type of sexuality. We're not really saturated with the human experience of sexuality as most of us have it. What we're saturated with is a commodified version. It's thin white women's bodies. Like that's what we're saturated with. Those are the messages that make people feel bad about their own bodies and think that only certain bodies are allowed to experience pleasure, are sexy, are allowed to be seen in public. You know, it's not the idea that sex toys are available that's going to make people feel any type of way. Like those are just tools that you're going to use according to, you know, your own personal needs.
Those tools will be available soon at select locations around Philadelphia. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Let's just hope the pink box doesn't do this to excited shoppers. All right, forget it. Coming up, can food increase our appetites for love?
Oh, this is delicious.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations that increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region. AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about love and lust. Now a trip to the zoo, the place where some of us catch our first ever glimpse of the strange ritual that is mating. Giant panda bears are pretty simple creatures in many ways. They love to eat bamboo. They love to nap. But there's one thing they don't seem to love. Mating. That is the rare sound of passionate pandas, but it almost never happens. They find it notoriously tough to procreate, and zoos around the world are trying to help them get into the mood. It's part of Brandy Smith's job. She is Associate Director for Animal Care Sciences at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and she's also giant panda curator there. And she joins us now to talk more. Hi, Brandy. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why do pandas have such trouble mating?
So pandas as a species do an excellent job breeding pandas in the wild. The pandas that we have in zoos aren't necessarily the most competent breeders, and there are no experienced animals to show them what to do. Our animals here at the zoo, Meishang and Tian Tian, came here essentially before they were even reproductive. So they've grown up together. They definitely do not think of each other as brother and sister. They're definitely interested in mating. But because neither of them ever had the opportunity to learn from a competent animal, they just can't quite figure out what to do.
That seems unusual, though. I mean, it seems like all animals kind of know how to do that.
Well, their instincts are on. So when they try to do it, they get so close. That's what's really heartbreaking. The problem is Meishang, we call it pancaking. So she lays flat down. And you can imagine that presents a difficult target for the male. An experienced male would pick her up. But Tian doesn't quite know what to do. So he just stomps on her a little bit.
When pandas mate in the wild, what's their ritual? What does that process look like?
They have such a small reproductive window that they can't be coy. They can breed about 1 to 2 days, one time a year. A female panda has to be incredibly obvious, and so her vulva swells. It turns a big, bright pink color. And if there is an available male in the neighborhood, she will turn around, she will lift her tail, and she will back up toward him. A lot of the cues are olfactory. A male will determine if she's worth his time or not. He'll wait for exactly the right time before he breeds with her.
Why is it so imperative, or why do zoos feel it's so imperative that these pandas procreate?
Well, pandas are an endangered species. We focus this much attention on all of our endangered species. The thing about pandas is that's the one the public is most interested in.
So what have you done to make this work, and what have other zoos done to make this work?
You know, Smithsonian's National Zoo is really spectacular, especially when it comes to our reproductive research and giant pandas. What we do every year is we give our pandas an opportunity to breed naturally. But then when they fail, our goal is always to create more pandas, to create more of this endangered species. So then we begin the process of artificial insemination, which involves collecting semen from the male and then inseminating the female.
And for that, I'm sure you have to carefully track when the female is ready.
Oh, we do, because we have to time it almost down to the minute. We look at their behaviors, and we also look at their hormones. So we collect pee. Every time the pandas pee, we collect it. And our hormone experts analyze the information, and they can tell us exactly when our pandas reach peak estrus.
So what's the status right now? Have you had any success?
This year was really an exciting year because not only did we inseminate our female with semen from our male here, but we also had an opportunity to bring in semen from a male in China who's actually a slightly better genetic match for our female. The insemination has already taken place, and now we're just waiting and hoping.
When will you find out?
When she has a baby. That's when we'll find out. late August or in September. Pandas are really spectacular because they either go through an actual pregnancy or a pseudo-pregnancy. And the pseudo-pregnancy is so fascinating because behaviorally, they act the same as a pregnant panda. Physiologically, they look the same as a pregnant panda. So there are actually changes in their uterus, whether they're pregnant or not. And even like biochemically, so we look at their hormones during this time, everything looks the same. The only way you can tell if she's actually pregnant instead of pseudo-pregnant is she has a baby.
What do we know about the panda population in zoos and also in the wild?
It's a success story in the making. The panda numbers are increasing. So in zoos, we've had phenomenal success with reproduction. We're over 300 animals, and they just did a survey, and there's been an increase in the number of pandas in the wild. So a little over 1,800 pandas have been counted in the wild.
But again, you will not know if your panda is pregnant until the baby comes.
No, we won't. Some zoos are able to do an ultrasound and to visualize the babies in utero before they're born. We try the ultrasounds, but what we've discovered with our panda, she is very particular, and as she comes closer to her due date, she wants nothing to do with us. She will not participate in the ultrasound. We have some incredibly experienced panda keepers here, so they're usually right on in terms of thinking if she's pregnant or not pregnant.
And they think she is pregnant?
We're hopeful. We are very hopeful this year.
Brandy, good luck with everything, and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. We're so excited here.
Brandy Smith is Associate Director of Animal Care Sciences at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and you can track the progress of this all-important panda pregnancy on Instagram. We have a link on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Our show today is about love and lust, and now let's return to us humans when it comes to these matters. To set the mood for desire, we often set the table. There's something very romantic about having a nice meal with a love interest, and there's also something sexy about food. I'm sure you remember the famous kitchen scene from the movie 9½ Weeks with Kim Basinger and Mickey Rourke. Here comes the olive, the cherries, the strawberries, the wine. Here's the cough syrup. What? The pasta, the jello. Ooh, the hot pepper. And eventually, the honey. All I can think about when I watch that is who's going to clean up the kitchen afterwards, but that's just me. A lot of people think that foods have sexual superpowers that could add to our love lives. Tanya English investigates the enduring allure of aphrodisiacs.
So what do we know about the power of food to rev up sex drive? Not much. Researcher Dolores Lamb hasn't seen any compelling evidence that any particular food can intensify desire.
Really, science has not figured out what determines sexual motivation and sexual attraction. if we knew the answer to that, we probably would be richer than Pfizer after they invented Viagra.
Lamb leads the Center for Reproductive Medicine at Baylor University and knows all about the intricacies of male plumbing. But sexual motivation is likely psychological, she says, and it's the brain that jumpstarts libido. Still, seems like there has to be something to the idea that gender stirs up lust or that hot peppers make you hot.
Probably for some folks they do, and it's certainly fun to try.
Lamb says there's no single food that boosts male hormones, but some legendary aphrodisiacs do have an active chemical here or a trace nutrient there. The watermelon, for example, is red and juicy, and it contains the amino acid citrulline. The nutrient is healthy for erectile tissue in both men and women, but there's not enough of it to make any difference in the bedroom. Also, consider chili peppers.
You get kind of a chill down the back of your neck and kind of a tingly good sensation.
Capsaicin in a jalapeno raises your metabolism and releases feel-good endorphins.
Maybe while you are eating those hot peppers, your brain remembers those feelings and goes, oh, I had a similar experience, except I was horizontal and not vertical, and I was with my lover. And so you start making those associations.
That's Susanna Mayer. She's a clinical sexologist in Philadelphia.
And my specialty is libido.
There's not a lot of research on aphrodisiacs, but in one trial, researchers fed saffron to men, then evaluated things like tip rigidity and tumescence. That's a measure of how swollen something gets. So Mayer conducted her own unscientific survey in her adult sex ed class. It's called the Erotic Literary Salon.
I asked them, had anybody ever experienced the effects of food that was considered an aphrodisiac? Not one hand went up.
People at the discussion group said they do get turned on when they watch an intimate partner eat. And that suggests a whole different category of aphrodisiacs, food that remind us of our anatomy. For example, avocados. They have a creamy center and they grow in pairs, literally two globes of ripe, low-hanging fruit. Food scientist Kathy Capica says sexual innuendo may be the most important active ingredient. That or culture.
In ancient Persia, for example, young couples would sit under pistachio nut trees. So in that part of the world, the pistachio nut could be considered the love nut.
Capica is a nutritional consultant. She says the big thing that love foods have in common is that many were once considered rare or expensive. Think about champagne, dark chocolate, saffron, and oysters.
When do you eat oysters? Usually when you go out, it's a special occasion, you're with that special someone, maybe you order oysters to impress them.
Oysters are also a good source of zinc, and zinc is important to sperm production. So it makes sense then that oysters have a bawdy reputation. But Capica says that doesn't make it science.
They don't have any superpower that's going to make you a super lover.
But you know, it's fun to try. So we headed to the Oyster House. It's a swanky raw bar in Philadelphia. It was packed with singles after work, and in the middle, a horseshoe bar with oysters piled high on ice.
How are you? These are Massachusetts oyster from Buzzards Bay.
Sam Mink is the owner.
And then on the other side here, we have Sweet Amalia oysters, which are a local oyster grown in Delaware Bay.
The goddess of love, Aphrodite, was born from a giant scallop. Perhaps that's why couples sometimes canoodle at the seafood bar over a plate of oysters.
We also have quite a few gentlemen. It's always older gentlemen that ask us, please, make sure one of these works.
When sexologist Susanna Mayer looks around, she suspects there's some kind of arousal feedback loop that happens when you see an oyster slip between someone's lips.
You know, some of them are curved, some of them are more rounded, or I should say oval. And I think you could, in fact, say they look like a vulva. I mean, we could probably say anything does, depending on what state of mind you were in.
Let's try that.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm just dipping this into this wonderful sauce here. Mm. So we think of this word slimy in a very negative way, but it does have a slimy texture to it, but I like it. It feels really good to the mouth.
So like the scientist, the sexologist says, the power of an aphrodisiac is mostly about belief and anticipation.
because your brain says, oh, it's going to turn me on.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Oh, this is delicious. Mmm.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Karen Chakurji is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our managing editor. Megan Pinto, the executive producer. We had help this week from producer Sophie Reed. Chris Tullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and also on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And that's also where you can get in touch with us. We always love to hear from you, so please send us your questions, your feedback, your ideas. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.